Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Now, in front of me now, I have a writer from Waterford who burst onto the scene 2 years ago with her electrifying debut novel, Acts of Desperation. It was a close-up and painfully incisive look at the tormented, coercive relationship, and it met with great critical acclaim. Well, now her follow-up novel, Ordinary Human Feelings, is about a mysteriously troubled, benefit-claiming Irish family and a child found dead on their London council estate. According to The Guardian, it leaves your heartstrings taut as a cheese wire. Meghan Nolan, no spoilers, because because two-thirds of the way through, I think that is how I feel. Look, the reviews in the UK, Meghan, have been amazing. The real deal, a masterful novel. Just some of the reviews that have been coming in. Part of it is based in Waterford. Was this a big homecoming for you in a sense?
It was, yeah. It was a real pleasure actually to set it in some. Yeah, so I think I'd say about a third of it is set in Waterford. Sort of most of this kind of section set in the past, in the 50s and 70s, and those are set in Waterford. And yeah, it was actually a real treat to do it because I live in London and I didn't get home. Obviously, over the last 3 years, I was home a lot less because of COVID. And it's a nice excuse to call my dad and go, what was the cinema called in 1980? And, you know, look, I was looking at all these Facebook groups. There's one called I Am Waterford, where people like post pictures of their, you know, their granny in 1950 at a dance or whatever. And yeah, it was kind of just a real pleasure to go and look at those things and get a sense of the place.
Were you nervous about bringing that sense of the place back home? Like, I was looking at your reviews, the FT, the Telegraph, the Times, the Guardian, and then you're putting your hometown on show. Were you nervous about the reception it would receive and your depiction of Waterford?
I'm sure there'll definitely be some mistakes I've made that people will love to point out in Waterford, you know, like about a certain street or whatever. But no, actually, I was really excited. And of the people, only a handful of people that I actually know have read the book so far, because it's only just come out, but of those people, three or four of them are from Waterford, and when the Waterford ones liked the book, it kind of meant more to me, you know, just because, yeah, obviously I really love Waterford and I want people from there to enjoy the book. And also, like, I know, being from there, when you did see Waterford represented in the media or in a book or whatever, it was so exciting when I was a kid, so it's nice to try and do that as well.
And I know you've been spending obviously time in London, actually, like the family, the Green family, in this book, but do you worry about when you go away? Like, I mean, do you kind of think I'm losing my accent or I'm losing my sense of touch? Do you kind of, do you miss that minutiae of life back home?
Yeah, very much. And I definitely so aware of my accent. I have a very like suggestible, my linguistic habit where no matter where I am, I sort of fit into it really
quickly. I'm here in pure Waterford.
Really? Okay, that's good to hear. I've just come from Waterford, so maybe that's it.
When you go home for a weekend.
Yeah. But no, I do worry about that. And it's really important to me to try and get back there as often as I can. And yeah, kind of every time I go there, it feels quite meaningful. And yeah, I love to be there.
And tell me about growing up in Waterford, because you came from a very, very creative family.
I did, yeah. So yeah, I grew up, both my parents are very creative people, but and huge readers, both of them, which was the main thing really, was that there was always an endless supply of books around. And yeah, my dad is a playwright and he began a theatre company called Red Kettle.
Yeah, he founded it.
And so that was kind of the backdrop of my childhood. And my mum was a brilliant singer and a huge reader and kind of just an all-round, you know, creative wonder.
So did your evolution into the writing life or the creative life then, was that sort of quite normal for you then? Was it a...
Yeah, it was very organic. Like, I was always writing stories and I was mad into poetry basically for my first like 10 years as a writer were all about poetry.
Did you keep much of it?
Oh, I think my dad has it, you know, like in some scrapbook or other. But
well, if the reviews keep going the way you're going, you're going to be able to donate your archive. This novel, there is an incredible cast of characters in the book, one of who is Tom, who is a tabloid journalist who you've just captured so well. But the kernel of the book, as I understand it, came from Gordon Burns, somebody's husband, somebody's son, about Peter Sutcliffe. Can you explain what that inspiration was and how it played out in this book for you? Again, no spoilers.
Yes, I will. I'm just trying to keep on top of the no spoilers. No, it should be fine. So yeah, I read, he's a brilliant author who I have loved for years now. And I read that book in, I think it was 2018. And I actually deliberately haven't ever gone back to double check this anecdote that inspired me, just in case I misremembered it or I got too inspired by it. You know what I mean? But as I remember Irish. There was a very throwaway line in it about after Sutcliffe had, either after he'd been arrested or was being put on trial, where a tabloid journalist had approached Sutcliffe, some of Sutcliffe's family, who were working class people, many of whom quite alcoholic, and they'd offered them a situation where this newspaper would put them up in a hotel, give them endless alcohol, as much alcohol as they wanted, a bit of pocket money, and the deal was that they were kind of sequestered there as a source on tap for this newspaper, and they weren't allowed to talk to anyone else. And I just thought, oh my God, that hotel, like, what? The idea of that pressure cooker of these people in the most dramatic, disturbing moment of their lives, all being kept in a hotel together.
And being exploited in that way. I don't want to give too much away, but the premise of this novel is both stark and dark. It's the death of a child who is assumed to have been murdered by another child. I was thinking of, you know, when this book is set, you know, quite contemporary in 1990, you know, before the Jamie Bulger case. Was it cases like that, again, that were feeding into your conscious or subconscious, or were, how were you drawn to what is a very, very dark proposition?
Yeah, there was a couple of kind of key works over the years that that had informed that interest, where there was actually, I think the very first thing I encountered about it was there was a play by there was an adaptation of a book called Boye that was made into a play and also a Channel 4 show, which was a kind of imagining of a child killer who after their release when they're an adult. And so I encountered that maybe in 2010. And then I started to read a little bit more academically about it. And there was a great book called The Sleep of Reason by David Thompson, which is about the trial of the two killers of Jamie Bulger.
And of course, there's a twist in this. Again, in terms of the child who finds herself at the heart of this, the title "Ordinary Human Failings" is such a really, really, really beautiful title. And, you know, apropos of everything that's going on in the world at the moment, I felt that it really, it forces us to step back from demonising people and it forces us to confront our own human feelings and what happens when people find themselves in desperate situations.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of my background reading before I started writing the novel was I wanted to have some, obviously not very sophisticated understanding, but some understanding of the psychology of children who are capable of doing extreme violent acts. And there was stuff that I'd never heard of before that really struck me, like...
Such as?
Just the... Naturally, for a child of a certain age, that you can't really guarantee that they have a sense of the permanence of death, and there's all sorts of questions like that that you'll never really have any solid answer to about how aware or how what intent a child of a certain young age actually had, and that's obvious in a certain way, but that idea of not having an understanding of how permanent death is felt very striking and sad to me to think about.
There was one part I think where the child, when she's been led out by the police and she's holding the policeman's hand, but her mother's hand doesn't reach or fall for hers, and you're just thinking, oh my goodness, this is a child that is at the centre of this. In one of the reviews, The Guardian says that desperation is your specialty. When you look in the novel, the big themes that you tackle, it's families, it's intergenerational trauma, intergenerational guilt, and then what might be described as the ordinary human feelings that many families encounter, alcoholism, you know, crisis pregnancy, mental health. Do you think that's Irish writers seem to do this very well. And I'm just wondering, is that a uniquely Irish state, or are we perhaps just a little bit more dysfunctional than others? Why do we consistently, generation after generation, capture these dynamics so well?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Or why are we drawn to them?
Yeah, and I'm aware of, I was chatting with my dad the other day about, you know, what you might be afraid of in terms of reception to the book or whatever. And I am aware that the subject matter is quite, you know, could be considered a little bit like cliched Irish stuff. And I hope it stands on its own merit or whatever. But it is a thing that I was aware of as I was writing it. I was going, oh, an alcoholic. Oh, crisis pregnancy. Is this going to be...
But it's incredibly rich terrain.
It is. And yeah, I think, I mean, I can't really speak for anyone but myself. But like the reason I'm attracted to writing about those things is that they're so present in my life and like have been, as in not those direct experiences necessarily, but like addiction and unwanted pregnancy in Ireland are two things that were a huge backdrop for.
Because it's
life,
really, really interesting. Sometimes writers get affronted when you suggest to them, you know, was this work a piece of exorcism? Was this something, you know, you were working out? And I think sometimes unfairly placed on female authors, you know, just saying, is this in some sense autobiographical, or why were you drawn to this? But you have, in particular, in this book, you've an incredible sympathy, an agonising sympathy, perhaps, for people who are struggling with addiction.
Yeah. I find it very moving, and like in several different characters in the book, I'm sort of using them to express fears that I've had about my own life and things that could have gone a certain way for me, and that I'm still afraid of it maybe, and kind of using these characters to play out the most extreme versions of what might happen. And so, yeah, like Richie, who's the character who's an alcoholic in the book, certainly is someone who, yeah, I feel like almost moved to tears when I even talk about him, because I felt so protective of him when I was writing the story. And yeah, that's because lots of us are on the precipice of going too far with certain things, and we never quite get there. But seeing someone like Richie who does, you know, you're very close to the bone with that kind of thing.
Because I think what you explore in it, sometimes addiction and those kind of issues are frustrating to people outside of it or who have never experienced it. But you really, really capture the trauma that leads to all of that and how people get. Do you have, in writing this, are you addressing nearly a fear that you might someday, or that fear maybe that people have, that we're all only perhaps a couple of steps away from life not going the way we'd planned?
It's not so much about that I feel like it might happen to me, but it's just that I feel like certainly there have been times where I did drink way too much and sometimes still do drink too much, and it's something I have to be aware of. But no, it's not about a fear that I will become like Richie. It's more that his motivations for being an addict are about concealing this extreme loneliness and terror of loneliness. Yeah. And that's something that I experience. And so, yeah, it's more about relating to the core, you know, motives for his alcoholism, rather than actually fearing that I will end up in the gutter or whatever. It's more just this acknowledgement that extreme loneliness is at the core of him.
Yeah. And what about, because obviously crisis pregnancy also looms large, you know, in this book again. Is that something that you were drawn to write about? We're probably a generation apart, you and I, so each generation, I suppose, confronts that issue
hugely,
when it arises,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
I didn't in advance think, I would love to have an abortion storyline in the book, but then actually it came up naturally enough because I was trying to think about, again, without giving too many spoilers or whatever, that there's a disconnect between this woman and her child, which I was trying to think about why she would feel so separated and so completely emotionally disengaged from her child. And I thought, if she was pregnant, if she had an unwanted pregnancy, which she then wasn't able to terminate, that could be a motivation for her feelings of disengagement. Anyway, so it kind of came about as character development rather than me wanting to put it in as an issue.
Yeah, it wasn't something you said at the beginning, said, okay, this book is going to continue.
No, but then I was glad it did. You know, once it became clear that it was going in, I then felt really good about that choice, and I felt like, actually this is important, and I feel like, you know, it's so recently that everything that, well, things changed, what was it, 5 or 6 years ago now, and people including me are quite eager to go, that was awful, and now let's move on and think about something else, and actually it's so present and recent still, and so, yeah, it did feel important to me to kind of portray that extreme terror of being pregnant in Ireland when that was cloaked in so much darkness.
Yeah, no, and it's interesting when you speak then about the mother and daughter relationships, you know, because often they're sort of fantasised and it's all best friends and everything, but actually one of the taboos is that sometimes we have very, very challenging relationships with it. And that was another sort of one of the, not quite taboo elements, but it was again a very, very rich vein of tapestry for you in this novel.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, there's this real, I don't know if you call it resentment, but this total separation between Carmel and her child, Lucy.
It's like a dissonance, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. She can't really consider her to be a human being because it's kind of too disturbing almost that she's responsible for this human being. And yet she had a really good relationship with her mother, Rose. And so there's all these kind of disturbing losses that happen between those generations where something is really is out of kilter by the time it gets to Lucy. And I totally agree with you. I think one of the reasons that I find the idea of having kids frightening and like why I don't have kids maybe is...
Why is that?
Well, loads of reasons, but one of them I think is that I'm not sure if I could avoid expressing that ambivalence that I have no doubt that I would feel about it. And it seems like I don't know if I could pretend to love it all the time, basically. And I don't.
Doesn't every woman or half-expectant mother perhaps have that fear that
definitely
maybe they won't connect? But is it something that is quite strong for you, that you fear that that ambivalence or indifference would play out in the same way as it has in this?
Not in the same way. I don't think. I'm a very loving person, and like I love kids or whatever, but it's not that I'm afraid of being like Carmel is, but I'm a fairly hard-headed, selfish person in many ways, and like I live my life exactly as I want to, pretty much. And you know, and that involves sacrifice. Means I can't have certain kinds of relationships in order to do the kind of work I want to do.
Do you feel a kind of a weight of expectation for women, and particularly young women, in a time when there are declining fertility rates, to want to be a mother? There's still that sort of pressure and that kind of idealized version of motherhood that we have.
I think most of my friends want children. Yeah, not that that's anything new. Like I think in the completely normal way of the world, like that most of my friends ambiently either want or are planning to have kids. And I just never wanted them. And yeah, I've talked to my mum about it a few times, and you know, kind of going, "Oh, should I be worried about this? Should I do it anyway? You know, just in case." And she was very encouraging of me to do it exactly, you know, to like follow my own path, and also that you know, it's not going to be too late if I change my mind in a few years, but also that it's fine for me to not have them.
When you compare this book to your debut novel, which was sort of quite focused because it was on a particular relationship, yet there is a huge amount of characters, all with their own individual storylines that you manage quite well. Did you always want to kind of write a piece about kind of it's sort of about an Irish family and an experience that would be very common to people? They leave Ireland, they go to London, they're outsiders, they're suspected.
I definitely wanted to do a family novel. That was always that's my favourite kind of novel to read, I suppose. And even though I'm very proud of Acts of Desperation, like my favourite style of novel is not that style of novel. It's closer to what this second one is, which is just kind of more traditional family drama in some ways. And yeah, also I had...
They're very exceptional.
not like ordinary, mundane family, but yeah, I think I'd always wanted to explore a family.
And also you explore kind of the migrant experience of, you know, going from Ireland to London and even fitting in. Like I think what was one of the kids' games at school that they played... IRA,
yeah.
You know, same with the people I play, like, you know, snatch the jumper or snatch the bacon, whatever it is. But that feeling of exclusion and becoming suspects very early on, or, you know, being made to feel different.
Yeah. And I think whether you want to say that that's about their Irishness or other aspects of their differences, but that, as is expressed through the tabloid storyline, I suppose, that there is this separating up of the good poor people and the bad poor people on the estate, and you know, like I've seen that play out in different places that I've lived in London and Ireland, where there's, you know, there's people who are considered to be the legitimate good working class people, and then there's the sort of sinister ones that you can't trust for whatever reason, whether it's that they're addicts or they're, you know, whether they have a certain background, whatever it might be. And yeah, I wanted to have some expression of this family being considered, you know, not without justification, but considered to be separate and sinister. And then the book is obviously about unveiling why those suspicions are pointed at them.
Did you feel that you had to leave Ireland? Is it, you know, what was your own journey to London?
No, I didn't. No, I was just in a kind of whimsical, I don't mean whimsical in a fun way, but I was in a point in my life where I didn't really have a lot going on here, and kind of very much on a whim decided to go to London for not very good reasons, basically. Like, there was a boy involved and very little work. And yeah, but yeah, then it worked out eventually. I mean, it took like 3 or 4 years until I was able to live in any kind of normal way there without having to move house every 6 weeks and whatever. But yeah,
I was thinking of you and coming from a I suppose an artist, you know, family. And I was just wondering, look, when you look at the pilot basic income for artists scheme that is being hailed internationally, do you think it is... that home is a good place for people who...
Do you actually? Yeah, yeah. For artists, I think here is really great. I think the Arts Council here are just... I think they're much better than my... Well, my perception of them is much better than the equivalent in Britain. And also, yeah, the universal income is a great initiative insofar... I was talking to somebody about this recently and how, like, there's a lot of non-quantifiable value that artists give to Ireland in terms of, like, helping to support tourism culture. And, you know, there's lots of things that you can't... monetize about art in Ireland, that but actually does help Ireland as a country. And it's important to recognise that, and that you can't necessarily make a commercial living from it.
I was just listening to the business just before we come on air talking about the next generation, which is the Gen Alphas.
Oh, yeah.
People are even younger than you. And I was just wondering, because things go in swings and roundabouts, your work, your early work was quite confessional. And we saw that era of the personal essay. Mm. And so many great female Irish writers really, really led the way on that. Do you think that will change? Do you think that that will kind of peak and come back? Or how do you feel about that early confessional style? Like, I mean, do you find your writing is changing?
Yeah, mine has changed, I think. And that's partially to do with, you know, the freedom of writing. Before you have any audience, you're going to be more bold in what you say. And then when you have a career, you'll change a little bit. But but yeah, no, I think obviously that kind of confessional boom was influenced by the internet quite a lot. But I think there's always going to be brilliant first person writing. And a lot of the time, you know, it was quite controversial whether that was a good style of writing or not. But actually, I think these things always come down to, if you're a good writer, you'll write a good confessional piece. And if you're a bad one, then you'll write a bad confessional piece, you know.
And where do you think kind of the state or the art of autofiction lies now?
As in, who do I think is really good? Or
well, no, just even that kind of genre, that phenomenon.
I think it's a bit outdated. I think people are trying other things at the moment that, like, you know, it's not the cutting edge experimental thing that it was 10, 15, even then it wasn't new, but I think it was like the...
Comes in cycles. Exactly,
yeah. I think it was like the dominant MFA thing to try and become successful at a while ago. And now I think people are being a bit more experimental with their fiction.
And a lot of people would have come across your work initially through social media. It's interesting watching people younger than I, and their relationship with social media is changing. What is your relationship with it now?
I just try not to think about it terribly much. Like, I use Instagram, but I think things have changed since I think, like, oversharing for kids younger than, I'm not a kid, I'm 33, should not refer to myself as a kid. But for people younger than me, rather, I think, like, oversharing is considered, like, really embarrassing, and having, like, too much of a presence online is considered embarrassing, which is interesting, because when I was growing up, it was, like, all you
Everything.
Wanted to do.
Yeah, it was oversharing. So you think that might go back? In terms of... it's really interesting, even at a tender age of 33, the range of your writing and the different styles. How do you feel about going into, you wrote a libretto, I think. Was it Amanda Fieri's A Thing I Cannot Name? So it's an opera. You're in a band as a teenager. You've said you're a poet as well. But what about TV and the prospect of Acts of Desperation becoming a TV show? How do you feel about that?
It's in process at the moment. All these things, as you know, I'm sure, like, take forever or never happen. So I don't really have a lot of strong.
Authors tend to shrug.
Yeah, you don't want to get excited about it either. But no, I'm really enjoying. There's a brilliant woman writing the pilot and series outline, and so I'm kind of advising her basically on certain elements of the plot, and we're working together quite loosely, but I'm enjoying that a lot, and I would like to try and do it myself in future.
It gives me great heart to learn that you wrote Acts of Desperation in small chunks of time around your journalism work. But tell us, before I let you go, Megan Nolan, what is next? Is there going to be a third?
Yes, definitely. But I also want to write non-fiction books, so I don't know which order they'll come in. So I'm going to work on both those ideas over the next few months and figure out which to prioritise, but they'll both come out at some point. I'll just be working away on those for the next couple of years.
Are you living, as kids, little people younger than us say, are you living your best life? It seems like you are.
Yeah, I'm very lucky. I have a great life, I think. Yeah,
it's absolutely fantastic. Your parents must be absolutely proud of you, as is all of Waterford.
Thank you.
No doubt, I'm sure. But look, Megan Nolan, thank you so much. Ordinary Human Feelings is published by Jonathan Cape. It's in all good bookstores from July the 13th. I'm going home to finish it this evening. Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Will take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.